Thanks. This is an initial comment. I'm glad that Noel and Keith went before me. They've really laid the groundwork for a lot of the concepts and issues I'm going to be chatting about. And as Keith mentioned, I'll touch on generally some of the work we've been doing at Michigan State University regarding emission factors, Tier 2 approaches to this work. I won't talk about models in particular. What I'll try to concentrate more on is our experiences, if you like, in the voluntary carbon market, trying to adopt methodologies and projects which can be utilized, hopefully in the future, by farmers and aggregators to change their nitrogen management practices. So that's where I'll be focusing my talk. So this initial overview of the presentation, I'll briefly touch on markets and offsets, some brief descriptions there. I'll talk about some of the nitrous oxide protocols that are out there, the nitrogen management protocols, and also some barriers to implementation. As I say, Keith and Noel have mentioned these before. I'll put them to a more specific context of the work that we've been doing at Michigan State University, which has been funded by the Electric Power Research Institute. First of all, environmental markets are hardly a new concept. They've been around in the U.S. for 30 or 40 years, mostly in terms of water management, remediation, etc. More recently, there's been, as we can see, an increased potential for the carbon markets to be involved as a source of on-farm income, with more opportunities to generate these credits, as we talk about these offsets, using current practices, traditional practices, and maybe some new agricultural practices, precision agriculture, etc., a whole suite, potentially, of practices that could be incorporated into these carbon offsets. Just a brief overview of trading and offsets here and what an offset is. I don't want to go into too much detail. This is a very simplified schematic here. You have two effective blocks there. On the x-axis, you've got the, if you like, the regulated entity, the electric power plant, for instance. Then you have an offset provider, in this case, agriculture or forestry, as Keith has talked about. On the y-axis, some greenhouse gas emissions. So you see the top dotted line there. Prior to that, I'll just talk about a before scenario. So if you like, this is a before a project implementation on a farm occurs. But what happens here, we have like a baseline scenario where in the before scenario, the agriculture, the farm, for instance, is emitting a certain amount of greenhouse gases. And also, in this case here, the regulated entity is emitting a certain amount of greenhouse gases. And what happens with the adoption of a project, a practice change, in our case, we'll be talking about nitrogen management practice changes, you'll get this reduction from a baseline emission for a particular management practice. And what would happen is, if in this case, the simplified case here, that reduction in emissions would provide the offset for the actual regulated entity to reduce their emissions. They can purchase this offset in order to meet a certain cap that's been imposed by a regulated body. And Noel, I don't want to get into the details of the philosophy of whether it's a good approach or not. I have my same concerns that Noel has as well. That's for discussion afterwards. But this is just a general overview of the actual transaction that occurs. And if you're lucky, you may get one of these little stamps or carbon offset credit delivered to you. Just as a summary there. So it's a tradable credit for an emission reduction generated from an alteration in an agricultural management practice. And for all gases, what we typically do is we have a comparative index, and it's the CO2 equivalent, and it's based on the global warming potential of the three main greenhouse gases in agriculture, CO2, methane, and what we're mostly talking about here is nitrous oxide. Why are we talking about nitrous oxide? Well, prior to that, let me just talk about an issue that's came about when there was potentially some prior federal legislation going through the system. For the most part, there's perceived to be a domestic shortage of these offsets. When some of the bills that went through 2 or 3 years ago, there was not enough domestic agricultural offset credits to ever, in the short term, supply the amount of credits that industry would probably have needed to meet their caps. There was a big issue of a shortage in this in the circumstances. In general, what's required at the moment, the current approaches in the agricultural sector, typically are carbon sequestration, as Keith mentioned. Carbon accumulation through reduced tillage, etc. Also methane capture and destruction. So those are the most common agricultural offsets that are actually out there at the moment in some of these regional initiatives, which I'll briefly talk about later. But new project types are needed if there is going to be the shortage, particularly possibly in the Californian system with a cap and trade maybe coming into force next year. And obviously the promising area is nitrous oxide based upon why? A, because it's a major greenhouse gas emitted by U.S. agriculture. We're all aware of that. It's about 2/3 of the anthropogenic U.S. emissions. Also, it's got a high global warming potential, about 300, depending on which version of the IPCC you look at. It could be 310, it could be 296, it could be 298. Most of the offsets now are derived from the second assessment report, so 310 is a common accounting number, but about 300 is sufficient for our purposes today. As mentioned previously as well, the reductions are immediate. If you're not applying, for instance, in our case, if we're reducing an N rate, you're not applying that nitrogen. There's going to be no nitrous oxide produced. Also, the case of the leakage issue with regards to irreversibility, unlike carbon, and I don't want to dismiss the carbon storage option with tillage, but the reductions are irreversible. If it's not there in the first place, it cannot be reversed. The permanence issue as well, as we've discussed previously. So just some of the emerging offset opportunities, some of the organizations that are out there at the moment, and two of which MSU has been dealing with directly, and another one more indirectly. The Verified Carbon Standard used to be the Voluntary Carbon Standard. The American Carbon Registry, part of WinRock. The Climate Action Reserve, which Noel talked about a little more in depth, and I'll not touch so much on that. And also a couple of initiatives, regional initiatives, the Western Climate Initiative and the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, which do have offsets in their accounting methodologies. Where are those? What's the current N2O protocols on the books, if you like, of these organizations? The VCS, the protocol that we're developing, trying to develop MSU EPRI and the American Carbon Registry, they already have a validated, verified offset methodology based upon the ACR, based upon a PACAD funding, and it's the DNDC model. Tier 3 process-based model, as Keith talked about. Also, we, MSU, also have currently trying to undergo validation. The MSU EPRI model is also in that arena as well. And as mentioned before, as Noel's talk, the Alberta have a carbon offset mostly based around the 4R management for nitrogen, right rate, right time, right placement, right source, etc. So what are the challenges? And I don't want to repeat again too much of what Keith and others have talked about. What are they? We need some robust science in order to provide the accountancy tools for these. There needs to be some genuine environmental benefits, real environmental integrity, if you like. The methods, for the most part, need to be as transparent as we can make them to all the stakeholders involved. All the stakeholders are not going to have an in-depth knowledge of carbon and nitrogen biogeochemistry, so there needs to be at least some more straightforward approach without losing the scientific integrity or the environmental benefits associated with it. And that's a tough balance, as effectively what we're all talking about here, is what's this balance that we can effectively please everyone, and that may or may not result in the best science, it may or may not result in the best methodology, but it's a route that we have to go down in order to try to, if we feel these are a good option for reducing nitrous oxide emissions, we need to deal with all stakeholders. And it needs to be straightforward. It's great to have a methodology which may be robust and straightforward, but how easy is a project to implement based upon that accounting methodology? And that leads on to the project that would be associated with the methodologies. It's effectively a contract to reduce, in our case, nitrous oxide emissions. It could be to reduce nitrate, and that's another issue we can discuss with regards to the co-benefits of reducing N rate. But again, it probably needs to have low farmer effort. If a farmer is wanting to be involved in these offset protocols, with regards to data, documentation, the amount of invasiveness of a number of people coming to the farm, verifying, validating, you really probably don't want a lot of extra effort involved in the farmer's point of view. How much data does he have already? Is this data already collected for instance, EQIP or CSP programs? I'd suggest that extra effort will lead to a lot less uptake of these methodologies, of these projects based on these methodologies. So first, again, the project needs to be there such that there's a fast adoption and a broad uptake, and we can talk a little bit more about performance standards and additionality, and again, Keith talked about that, and I'll touch on them myself, and maybe it's more suitable for a conversation after this, but there's a lot of complexity associated with validation and verification of these projects. So what are the benefits, ideally, if we have an end management practice in the form of an offset? It'll reduce agricultural greenhouse gases. As we discussed, N2O is the most important, certainly in cropland agriculture, with high amounts of external synthetic fertilizer. It'll also reduce what we term reactive N, as I mentioned before, not just nitrous oxide, potentially nitric oxide, nitrate. It has all sorts of implications. Again, we're focusing on N2O, but certainly very well aware of the corollary benefits associated with better nitrogen management. It'll deliver an offset credit. Ideally, obviously, what we don't want is any productivity decline, and that's paramount to a farmer. His bottom line is he's not going to deliberately reduce his end rate such that he feels there's going to be an impact on his yield. There are options to game systems, and we can talk about those as well, but for the most part, a farmer's not going to accept a decline in yield, irrespective of the incentive, unless it's a very high incentive. And hopefully some of the incentives that will be adopted in these carbon markets will be sufficient, if you like, to potentially tip the balance to someone who maybe have been considering, but now with that incentive based upon the amount of money he'll get for his carbon credit, it may be enough to allow him to make that change. As I say, the financial compensation associated with that practice change. So just to go over some of the basics of what we talked about, and this will touch on what Keith mentioned about this Tier 1 and Tier 2 approach. The protocol that we've been developing and are trying to get validated is based upon some empirical field data on a number of studies in Michigan. The bottom axis there is the fertilizer N rate. The y-axis is the nitrous oxide emissions per hectare per year, derived from publications from a master's student, John Hoban, who spent a number of weeks and months and years in Michigan taking huge numbers of measurements, and publication that we also did, which was highlighting the potential for the accounting methodology. So the bottom dotted line there is, in effect, the IPCC, Tier 1, as it's termed, and the curvilinear line, exponential, whatever term you would like, is the nonlinear relationship that we actually found from the empirical work that we did on these number of studies over 2 or 3 years. So what's the advantage of that? That's just showing the sites where we did them in Michigan. If we think about a simple end rate reduction, and it almost doesn't matter where I put that on the curve, this is about a 15-20% reduction in end rate. What we see is that if we were using just a simple default from the IPCC, you would certainly get an associated reduction in nitrous oxide emissions. It would be there, but it would be relatively small. Whereas if the relationship that we found holds true on a number of other systems, and unfortunately, we haven't been able to test this. This is in a corn soybean rotations in Michigan, quite representative of the north central region in general. It would be great if more information like this was available on these nitrogen fertility gradients that we studied, and we'd certainly encourage more work to be done in that area. But what you'd see is that you get a much larger, if you like, bang for your buck, 3-4 times the amount of nitrous oxide emissions reductions. Obviously, that translates to a larger carbon credit, a larger CO2 equivalency, so there's more incentive for a financial compensation. Same end rate reduction, but a larger payback. So also, our protocol does try to incorporate flexibility to achieve this end rate reduction. And I know that Noel talked about numbers of management practices change in the CER process, where they were still uncertain as to how many practice changes we should adopt. We're not discouraging any practice change. What we're trying to do is just facilitate that practice change, and the only thing we're actually going to be, if you like, counting towards the carbon credit is an actual reduction in N rate. But there are many ways to get at a reduction in N rate. You could, for instance, economically optimize your nitrogen applications. Previously, for the most part, the last 2 or 3 decades, many farmers, particularly in the Corn Belt, have been looking at yield goals and using yield goals and other simple equations to look at their projected end rate recommendations for the future years, and these have been generally disproven to be not particularly accurate with regards to predicting the amount of N required for the best crop growth. We could split application, timing, fall fertilizer against spring fertilizer. Typically, you assume that the spring applied fertilizer to an annual crop would be a much better approach, less chance for loss of nitrogen over the winter period. Source, maybe a slow-release fertilizer, coated fertilizers, also nitrification inhibitors, urease inhibitors. We're not discluding these practices as legitimate. Our approach is just based upon the fact that if we use those approaches, the integrated result is that you are actually able to reduce your actual N rate. So how we account for the N rate is simple synthetic N application and organic N application. If you reduce that based upon any other practice changes that you can employ, you will get the credit for the end rate reduction, even though you may have had to adopt some other practices to get to that stage. And in doing so, that we feel is a more conservative approach based upon, in general, the lack of data out there to support N2 emission reductions associated with quite a large number of the practices that we've been talking about. End rate's certainly more well studied than most. There's certainly a lot of information out there from Minnesota and other that maybe changing end source might be appropriate, changing end depth, et cetera, and that's some of the questions we've been asked at the CAR with me and Noel being involved in. So what are the issues here? Baseline establishment, proving additionality, dealing with permanence and reversal, and I'll try not to repeat too much what what Keith was saying, and also proving no project leakage. These are the issues that generally a methodology and associated projects have to deal with. Baseline determination, what we're approaching it, is that we're requiring specific field data from whatever project site the farmer wants to involve in this project. So at least the past 5 years, depending on his rotation in that field, if it's, for instance, a corn soybean rotation, we might require 3 of the last 6 years from the corn if he's trying to reduce his N rate from the corn, depending on the rotation. I say at least the past 5 for instance, for continuous corn. Proof of practice. So records, as you see on the right-hand side of that slide there, there's all sorts of records that we have for a project that we're actually trying to associate with our methodology, a farmer that we have involved in the northern part of Michigan. So these are his photocopied real records, or at least representations of them. So we have data on N-fertilized application, which can prove he's been applying certain rates to the same crop at the same site for a number of years. Rotation history, and obviously some site coordinates, obviously what field are we talking about here, and some information on proof of ownership, some simple documentation showing that he either owns the land, in this case, and or rents the land and has a relationship with the landowner that can allow the actual the transaction of the credit. So proven additionality. There are a number of issues out there which require to be met in order for a project associated with methodology to be acceptable. I've just named a few here. There's usually a regulatory surplus, of course. There shouldn't be any conditions or laws or other frameworks in place that require that change in practice in the first place. Obviously, that would not then be additional for a farmer to adopt a practice which is already legally required or mandated. There's no additionality associated with that. He's probably breaking the law if he's not. So once those are met, there's other requirements. For instance, a performance standard, and also there's a project standard. Ideally, you'd be trying to edge towards a performance standard approach here. A lot of the criticism of, for instance, the CDM, the Clean Development Mechanism, was that it was too project-based, such that huge amounts of information and effort were required for a specific project, and it didn't cover the sectors and the areas so that other people could come along and use the methodology that was developed. They had to then develop their own methodology and their own projects. Obviously, a lot of extra time and effort. Consultancies were getting a lot of money. A lot of people were getting a lot of money, but it was very intensive with regards to getting a number of projects off the ground. So ideally we're looking for a performance standard such that farmers can, that many projects that come along have this framework, a way of looking at a simple, if you like, sectoral accountancy that they can look at and say, hey, I can use this basic framework to account for my N2 emissions reductions, and I have some site-specific conditions which I add to it, which you can check with my records. Also, of course, there's issues with less tangible concerns, shall we say, with, for instance, with corn fertilization in the Midwest, tradition and comfort, long-term history of a family applying a certain rate of N. There's a comfort with it. There's a perceived risk associated with reducing N rate and changing N management practice in general. It may lead to reduced yield. We're trying to show here that is not the case at all if the N is managed judiciously. So with dealing with permanence and reversal, again, I'll not repeat what I said previously about immediacy and irreversibility and permanence. There's no risk mitigation mechanisms for offsets. There's no requirement for, I think one of the ladies from Alberta mentioned about these risk buffer pools for the carbon sequestration issue. With the N2O, mitigation from N rate, there's no requirement for these pools to be in existence based upon the permanence and irreversibility of the credit. Potentially, as also discussed, is ideally you would like to see an aggregation of producers, not just one or two farmers, but a whole suite of farmers, maybe hundreds of farmers, thousands, who knows, that are all performing same practice or a similar practice to ensure that this potential heterogeneity or bias is removed from the issues associated with the quantification process. So proving no project leakage, again, what we're trying to show here is that even with N management changes and particular N rate reductions, there's a way to do that without reducing your yield. And if we're showing that there's no yield reduction, there's not an issue with leakage because what would occur if there's... excuse me, let me reverse back there. What typically has been happening in the past, as I mentioned before, is that there's been some yield goal estimates that farmers have typically been using. What we're trying to suggest is that maybe a good way to reduce the N rate but not reduce the yield is more of an economic approach to the ERN application. Again, the yield history, as I mentioned before, is a common approach in the 70s and 80s and 90s, and still is very common now. More recently, there's been this economic optimization in the Corn Belt through the Iowa State University have a corn end rate calculator. I'll show a little bit about that later. So it's based upon fertilizer and grain price ratios. And here's just a quick example of this calculator. It's available on the web at Iowa State University. And it looks at the various states in the north central region. And it looks at what nitrogen you're applying, the amount you're applying. And it calculates based on a ratio of the nitrogen price that you're applying and the corn price that you'd get at market. It looks at what's called the maximum return to nitrogen rate, this MRTN rate. And so you can generate these graphs from all the states that I mentioned in the calculator. And also what you see here on the right-hand graph is this shaded vertical bar, which is showing, if you like, the profitable rate, the rough profitable rate that you can apply, to which, if you see on the y-axis there, that the maximum yield is 100%, you're getting maybe minor reductions, but on average that would not be the case. And what is good about this approach here is that as more data comes in, more field trials come in from the north central region, they're inputted into this data set. So these values you see here, 143, 120 for Michigan and all the other states, they are modified by new trials coming in, this accessibility of the data set to more input as we go down the line. So, as mentioned, no yield reductions we're seeing, no yield compensation required outside the project boundary, as Keith mentioned. So if there's no compensation required outside of a project, there's no additional N use in order to compensate for any yield reduction. So no added N2 emissions. So as talked about before, there's not really, we see an issue with the leakage with regards to these N management practices, these types of carbon offset projects. What is the potential of this? This is the technical potential carbon volumes, just some quick, in effect, back of the envelope calculations from corn for the north central region. If we were to use that tier 2 emission factor that we developed in Michigan and applied it to the states that we that grow corn in the Midwest, using the corn acreage for USDA in 2011, we're talking about a very large number of million metric tons of CO2 equivalent that could be reduced. 67 is the calculation here. And not somewhat coincidentally, from recent publications, Sparrow et al., I think Keith was involved in that publication, estimated in the Conterminous US, based upon a number of management practices which could sequester carbon, on an annual basis in this case, I'll point that out, is about 66 million metric tons of CO2. The above figure is based on typical project period lengths of 5 years, so divide by 5 to get an annual. But it's still a very, very substantial number. And, of course, these are technical potentials, but it just shows that relatively small reductions in N rate based upon MRTN profitable ranges, maybe a 10 to 15% reduction in N rate without causing any yield issues, can generate an awful lot of emission reduction credits based upon the high global warming potential of N2O. So just in conclusion, we could argue this. Carbon credits are needed. Maybe so, maybe not. Then Noel will have some discussions on that. Agriculture can certainly provide them, without a doubt. I think there's an incentive to do that, depend on the market, depend on the carbon prices, and these are all discussions that can be had outside of this framework. Obviously, N2O reduction is a promising source. It's high global warming potential. Its removal from the atmosphere is beneficial. The protocols that we need to have, and which some are to some extent, they need to be robust and transparent. They need to be science-based. There needs to be validation of the models, as Keith was talking about, whether they be simple statistical models, tier 2 emission factors, side-by-side comparisons, or process-based models. They need to be validated. They need to be have great data sets, and there's a real drive to get more information and more information, particularly on N2O and a lot of the U.S. agricultural systems. And as has been pointed out before, there's a plethora of studies and a real exponential rise in the number over the last few years, it would seem, at least to my eyes. But what do the projects need to be? They need to be low cost and they need to have low complexity. No use having a great, fantastic, complex model or even a simple model that no one can actually use. They need to be low cost. They need to be low cost for implementation. We need to think of the end users here, and hopefully that'll be the farmers and the aggregators that associate with the farmers. We need to have it readily deployable over a large area of the U.S. agriculture in whatever crop or region that may be. And I just wanted to put in context, and to some extent what Keith has mentioned as well, that we're talking here about carbon credits from greenhouse gases. We could equally look at N management, and of course other USDA programs do, in terms of nutrient removal, water quality, Gulf of Mexico, we've all heard of that issue with the Mississippi. ecosystem remediation. And this doesn't have necessarily to be in the voluntary market. That's what I've been talking about today. There's the cap and trade issue in California in a compliance market. There's the issue that I touched on of credit stacking. If you change one management practice, can you then gain a credit from your nitrous oxide reduction, gain a credit from your nitrate removal? How many credits can you add? Are they additive? Are they integrative? Lots of questions that have been asked before, but are still pertinent to the current situation. And again, rewards and incentives, voluntary programmatic, conservation programs, the CSP in particular, and the QIP if they tend to merge. A lot of these management practice changes that farmers are already provided money for can ideally, and to some extent, be integrated into the sort of the requirements that someone would need for claiming carbon credits from, for instance, an NRA reduction. And also, of course, these public-private alliances. So in conclusion, I just want to put the slide up which shows what I've just discussed. Carbon credits are needed. Agriculture can provide them. N2O is obviously the promising source. The protocols and projects need to be robust and low-cost and transparent. And with that, I thank you very much.
We have time for a quick question or two. No one wants to buy carbon credits?
You're not alone. Hi, okay.
The reduction, the farmer will get paid for the reduction of nitrate fertilizer applying less nitrate per acre. But what about if he set aside like a legumin of crop for forage and he's not applying on that area, but he continues to apply on
No, I mean, the way it's, and Noel touched on it, it's quite specific. I mean, we're talking about one site, one project. You can have a number of project sites, i.e. a number of fields on a farm that you could enroll in the carbon market, in theory. But anything that wouldn't be, anything that you couldn't get a history on, that you couldn't then establish a baseline. Well, no, that all right, yeah. So if you right, you're like splitting a field and then applying a, and at least in our approach, that wouldn't. If you then, from that action, if then that led to a reduction in the amount of synthetic application to that part of the field, if I understand this correctly, you would then generate an energy reduction and a credit for N2 emissions. Right. If it was part of the project field, it would.
Yeah.
Maybe I misunderstand it. We can chat about that. But.
Other thoughts on how this might be, how this approach might be integrated into the conservation stewardship program or the conservation management tool that's used to evaluate the total benefit of the practices that a farmer is proposing to use.
Right, well, that's a tough. Yeah, no, I almost wish I hadn't, but no, it's. I noticed that, for instance, from our CAR approach, that a number of the practices that were suggested were derived indirectly, at the very least, from the CSP. And I'm not so familiar with that program, but I think USDA and others are currently trying to generate new inventories for calculating greenhouse gas emissions from the U.S. at regional levels, and are trying to obviously promote more. Regional, if you like, tier two emission factors and more side-by-side comparisons. How it would be actually incorporated, I'm not sure. Maybe not too much of a stretch to think that the same credits that they have for water quality directives, etc., could be extended to greenhouse gas emissions. That would be beyond my ability to maybe suggest. Maybe someone else has some more suggestions about how that would go, but it would seem similar. A missed opportunity, at the very least, if you weren't able to add the other environmental benefits associated with a management practice change on a farm, not just to a water quality issue, but also to a greenhouse gas mitigation issue. Hopefully there will be an option to do that.